Similarly, meetings that occur every week are easier to remember than those that occur every other week. Some medicines are taken once a week, and most patients take this medicine on Sundays, because that day is different from other days for most people, and thus easy to associate with taking one's medicine. Birth control pills present a special problem along these lines, because they are taken every day for 3 weeks and then skipped for 1 week. To solve this problem and to make the process automatic, the pills are typically sold in a special container that contains 28 pills, each in a numbered compartment. Patients are instructed to take a pill every day, in order. The pills for days 22 through 28 are placebos, whose only role is to facilitate compliance for human users. While working on this book, Thaler sent an email to his economist friend, Hal Varian, who is affiliated with Google. Thaler intended to attach a draft of the introduction to give Hal a sense of what the book was about, but forgot the attachment. When Hal wrote back to ask for the missing attachment, he noted with pride that Google was experimenting with a new feature on its email program, Gmail, that would solve this problem. A user who mentions the word attachment but does not include one would be prompted. Did you forget your attachment? Thaler sent the attachment along and told Hal that this was exactly what the book was about. Visitors to London who come from the United States or Europe have a problem being safe pedestrians. They have spent their entire lives expecting cars to come at them from the left, and their automatic system knows to look that way. But in the United Kingdom, automobiles drive on the left-hand side of the road, and so the danger often comes from the right. Many pedestrian accidents occur as a result. The City of London tries to help with good design. On many corners, especially in neighborhoods frequented by tourists, the pavement has signs that say, "Look right." Give feedback. The best way to help humans improve their performance is to provide feedback. Well-designed systems tell people when they are doing well and when they are making mistakes. Some examples. Digital cameras generally provide better feedback to their users than film cameras. After each shot, the photographer can see a small version of the image just captured. This eliminates all kinds of errors that were common in the film era, from failing to load the film properly, or at all, to forgetting to remove the lens cap, to cutting off the head of the central figure of the picture. However, early digital cameras failed on one crucial feedback dimension. When a picture was taken, there was no audible cue to indicate that the image had been captured. Modern models now include a very satisfying but completely fake shutter click sound when a picture has been taken. Some cell phones, aimed at the elderly, include a fake dial tone for similar reasons. An important type of feedback is a warning that things are going wrong, or even more helpful, are about to go wrong. Our laptops warn us to plug in or shut down when the battery is dangerously low. But warning systems have to avoid the problem of offering so many warnings that they are ignored. If our computer constantly nags us about whether we are sure we want to open that attachment, we begin to click yes without thinking about it. These warnings are thus rendered useless. The Department of Homeland Security's color-coded terror alert system is a nice illustration of feedback that would be useless even if it weren't incessant. When walking through an American airport any time since 2002, one is bound to hear the following announcement. The Department of Homeland Security has raised the National Threat Advisory to orange. Aside from putting our toiletries into a 1-quart Ziploc bag, exactly what actions are we expected to take as a result of this warning? A look at the Homeland Security website provides the answer. We are told, all Americans should continue to be vigilant, take notice of their surroundings, and report suspicious items or activities to local authorities immediately. Weren't we supposed to be doing that at level yellow? It is a safe bet that these announcements are useless. Much more useful would be a supply of 1-quart Ziploc bags for absent-minded travelers, and many airports do in fact provide these. Feedback can be improved in many activities. Consider the simple task of painting a ceiling. This task is more difficult than it might seem because ceilings are nearly always painted white, and it can be hard to see exactly where you have painted. Later, when the paint dries, the patches of old paint will be annoyingly visible. How to solve this problem? Some helpful person invented a type of ceiling paint that goes on pink when wet, but turns white when dry. Unless the painter is so colorblind that he can't tell the difference between pink and white, this solves the problem. Understanding mappings, from choice to welfare. Some tasks are easy, like choosing a flavor of ice cream. Other tasks are hard, like choosing a medical treatment. Consider, for example, an ice cream shop where the varieties differ only in flavor, not calories or other nutritional content. Selecting which ice cream to eat is merely a matter of choosing the one that tastes best. If the flavors are all familiar, such as vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry, most people will be able to predict with considerable accuracy the relation between their choice and their ultimate consumption experience. Call this relation between choice and welfare a mapping. Even if there are some exotic flavors, the ice cream store can solve the mapping problem by offering a free taste. Choosing among treatments for some disease is quite another matter. Suppose you were told that you have been diagnosed with prostate cancer and must choose among three options: surgery, radiation, and watchful waiting, which means do nothing for now. Each of these options comes with a complex set of possible outcomes regarding side effects of treatment, quality of life, length of life, and so forth. Comparing the options involves making such trade-offs as the following. Would I be willing to risk a one-third chance of impotence or incontinence in order to increase my life expectancy by 3.2 years? This is a hard decision at two levels. First, the patient is unlikely to know these trade-offs, and second, he is unlikely to be able to imagine what life would be like if he were incontinent. Yet here are two scary facts about this scenario. First, most patients decide which course of action to take in the very meeting at which their doctor breaks the bad news about the diagnosis. Second, the treatment option they choose depends strongly on the type of doctor they see. Some specialize in surgery, others in radiation. None specialize in watchful waiting. Guess which option we suspect might be underutilized. The comparison between ice cream and treatment options illustrates the concept of mapping. A good system of choice architecture helps people to improve their ability to map and hence to select options that will make them better off. One way to do this is to make the information about various options more comprehensible by transforming numerical information into units that translate more readily into actual use. If I am buying apples to make apple cider, it helps to know the rule of thumb that it takes 3 apples to make 1 glass of cider. Take the example of choosing a digital camera. Cameras advertise their megapixels, and the impression created is certainly that the more megapixels, the better. This assumption is itself subject to question because photos taken with more megapixels take up more room on the camera's storage device and a computer's hard drive. But what is really problematic for consumers is translating megapixels, not the most intuitive concept, into what they care about. Is it worth paying an additional $100 to go from 4 to 5 megapixels? Suppose instead that manufacturers listed the largest print size recommended for a given camera. Instead of being given the options of 3, 5, or 7 megapixels, consumers might be told that the camera can produce quality photos at 4x6 inches, 9x12, or poster size. Often people have a problem in mapping products into money. For simple choices, of course, such mappings are trivial. If a Snickers bar costs $1, you can easily figure out how much it costs to have a Snickers bar every day. But do you know how much it costs you to use your credit card? Among the fees you may be paying are A, an annual fee for the privilege of using the card, common for cards that provide benefits such as frequent flyer miles, B, an interest rate for borrowing money, that depends on your deemed creditworthiness, C, a fee for making a payment late, and you may end up making more late payments than you anticipate, D, interest on purchases made during the month that is normally not charged if your balance is paid off but begins if you make your payment 1 day late, and E, a charge for buying things in currencies other than dollars. Credit cards are not alone in having complex pricing schemes that are neither transparent nor comprehensible to consumers. Think about mortgages, cell phone calling plans, and auto insurance policies, just to name a few. For these and related domains, we propose a very mild form of government regulation, a species of libertarian paternalism that we call RECAP. Record, evaluate, and compare alternative prices. Here is how RECAP would work in the cell phone market. The government would not regulate how much issuers could charge for services, but it would regulate their disclosure practices. The central goal would be to inform customers of every kind of fee that currently exists. This would not be done by printing a long, unintelligible document in fine print. Instead, issuers would be required to make public their fee schedule in a spreadsheet-like format that would include all relevant formulas. Suppose you were in Toronto and your cell phone rings. How much is it going to cost you to answer it? What if you download some email? All these prices would be embedded in the formulas. This is the price disclosure part of the regulation. The usage disclosure requirement would be that once a year, issuers would have to send their customers a complete listing of all the ways they had used the phone and all the fees that had been incurred. This report would be sent two ways, by mail and, more important, electronically. The electronic version would also be stored and downloadable on a secure website. Producing the RECAP reports would cost cell phone carriers very little, but the reports would be extremely useful for customers who want to compare the pricing plans of cell phone providers, especially after they had received their first annual statement. Private websites similar to existing travel sites would emerge to allow an easy way to compare services. With just a few quick clicks, a shopper would easily be able to import their usage data from the past year and find out how much various carriers would have charged given their usage patterns. Consumers who are new to the product, getting a cell phone for the first time, for example, would have to guess usage information for various categories, but the following year they could take full advantage of the system's capabilities. We will see that in many domains, from mortgages and credit cards to energy use to Medicare, a RECAP program could greatly improve people's ability to make good choices. Structure complex choices. People adopt different strategies for making choices depending on the size and complexity of the available options. When we face a small number of well-understood alternatives, we tend to examine all the attributes of all the alternatives and then make trade-offs when necessary. But when the choice set gets large, we must use alternative strategies, and these can get us into trouble. Consider, for example, Jane, who has just been offered a job at a company located in a large city far from where she is living now. Compare two choices she faces, which office to select and which apartment to rent. Suppose Jane is offered a choice of three available offices in her workplace. A reasonable strategy for her to follow would be to look at all three offices, note the ways they differ, and then make some decisions about the importance of such attributes as size, view, neighbors, and distance to the nearest restroom. This is described in the choice literature as a compensatory strategy, since a high value for one attribute, big office, can compensate for a low value for another. Loud neighbor. Obviously, the same strategy cannot be used to pick an apartment. In a large city like Los Angeles, thousands of apartments are available. If Jane ever wants to start working, she will not be able to visit each apartment and evaluate them all. Instead, she is likely to simplify the task in some way. One strategy to use is what Amos Tversky, 1972, called elimination by aspects. Someone using this strategy first decides what aspect is most important, say, commuting distance, establishes a cutoff level, say, no more than a 30-minute commute, then eliminates all the alternatives that do not come up to this standard. The process is repeated, attribute by attribute, no more than $1,500 per month, at least two bedrooms, dogs permitted, until either a choice is made, or the set is narrowed down enough to switch over to a compensatory evaluation of the finalists. When people are using a simplifying strategy of this kind, alternatives that do not meet the minimum cutoff scores may be eliminated even if they are fabulous on all other dimensions. So, for example, an apartment that is a 35-minute commute will not be considered even if it has a dynamite view and costs $200 a month less than any of the alternatives. Social science research reveals that as the choices become more numerous and or vary on more dimensions, people are more likely to adopt simplifying strategies. The implications for choice architecture are related. As alternatives become more numerous and more complex, choice architects have more to think about and more work to do, and are much more likely to influence choices, for better or for worse. For an ice cream shop with 3 flavors, any menu listing those flavors in any order will do just fine, and effects on choices, such as order effects, are likely to be minor because people know what they like. As choices become more numerous, though, good choice architecture will provide structure, and structure will affect outcomes. Consider the example of a paint store. Even ignoring the possibility of special orders, paint companies sell more than 2,000 colors that you can apply to the walls in your home. It is possible to think of many ways of structuring how those paint colors are offered to the customer. Imagine, for example, that the paint colors are listed alphabetically. Arctic white might be followed by azure blue, and so forth. While alphabetical order is a satisfactory way to organize a dictionary, at least if you have a guess as to how a word is spelled, it is a lousy way to organize a paint store. Instead, paint stores have long used something like a paint wheel, with color samples ordered by similarity. All the blues are together, next to the greens, and the reds are located near the oranges, and so forth. The problem of selection is made considerably easier by the fact that people can see the actual colors, especially since the names of the paints are spectacularly uninformative. On the Benjamin Moore Paints website, 3 similar shades of beige are called Roasted Sesame Seed, Oklahoma Wheat, and Kansas Grain. Thanks to modern computer technology and the World Wide Web, many problems of consumer choice have been made simpler. The Benjamin Moore Paints website not only allows the consumer to browse through dozens of shades of beige, but it also permits the consumer to see, within the limitations of the computer monitor, how a particular shade will work on the walls with the ceiling painted in a complementary color. And the variety of paint colors is small compared to the number of books sold by Amazon, millions, or web pages covered by Google, billions. Many companies, such as Netflix, the mail-order DVD rental company, succeed in part because of immensely helpful choice architecture. Customers looking for a movie to rent can easily search movies by actor, director, genre, and more, and if they rate the movies they have watched, they can also get recommendations based on the preferences of other movie lovers with similar tastes, a method called collaborative filtering. You use the judgments of other people who share your tastes to filter through the vast number of books or movies available in order to increase the likelihood of picking one you like. Collaborative filtering is an effort to solve a problem of choice architecture. If you know what people like you tend to like, you might well be comfortable in selecting products you don't know, because people like you tend to like them. For many of us, collaborative filtering is making difficult choices easier. A cautionary note: surprise and serendipity can be fun for people, and good for them too, and it may not be entirely wonderful if our primary source of information is about what people like us like. Sometimes it's good to learn what people unlike us like, and to see whether we might even like that. If you like the mystery writer Robert B. Parker, and we agree that he's great, collaborative filtering will probably direct you to other mystery writers. We suggest trying Lee Child, by the way. But why not try a little Joyce Carol Oates, or maybe even Henry James? If you're a Democrat, and you like books that fit your predilections, you might want to see what Republicans think. No party can possibly have a monopoly on wisdom. Public-spirited choice architects, those who run the daily newspaper, for example, know that it's good to nudge people in directions that they might not have specifically chosen in advance. Structuring choice sometimes means helping people to learn, so they can later make better choices on their own. Incentives. Our last topic is the one with which most economists would have started: prices and incentives. Though we have been stressing factors that are often neglected by traditional economic theory, we do not intend to suggest that standard economic forces are unimportant. This is as good a point as any to state for the record that we believe in supply and demand. If the price of a product goes up, suppliers will usually produce more of it, and consumers will usually want less of it. So choice architects must think about incentives when they design a system. Sensible architects will put the right incentives on the right people. One way to start to think about incentives is to ask 4 questions about a particular choice architecture. Who uses? Who chooses? Who pays? Who profits? Free markets often solve all of the key problems by giving people an incentive to make good products and to sell them at the right price. If the market for sneakers is working well, there will be a lot of competition. Bad sneakers will be driven from the market, and the good ones will be priced in accordance with people's tastes. Sneaker producers and sneaker purchasers have the right incentives, but sometimes incentive conflicts arise. Consider a simple case. When we go to our weekly lunch, each of us chooses his own meal and pays for what he eats. The restaurant serves us our food and keeps our money. No conflicts there. Now suppose we decide to take turns paying for lunch. Sunstein now has an incentive to order something more expensive on the weeks that Thaler is paying, and vice versa. In this case, though, friendship introduces a complication. One of us may well order something cheaper if he knows that the other is paying. Sentimental, but true. Many markets and choice architecture systems are replete with incentive conflicts. Perhaps the most notorious is the U.S. healthcare system. The patient receives the healthcare services that are chosen by his physician and paid for by the insurance company, with everyone from equipment manufacturers to drug companies to malpractice lawyers taking a piece of the action. Those with different pieces have different incentives, and the results may not be ideal for either patients or doctors. Of course, this point is obvious to anyone who thinks about these problems. But as usual, it is possible to elaborate and enrich the standard analysis by remembering that the agents in the economy are humans. To be sure, even mindless humans demand less when they notice that the price has gone up. But will they notice? Only if they are really paying attention. The most important modification that must be made to a standard analysis of incentives is salience. Do the choosers actually notice the incentives they face? In free markets, the answer is usually yes, but in important cases, the answer is no. Consider the example of members of an urban family deciding whether to buy a car. Suppose their choices are to take taxis and public transportation, or to spend $10,000 to buy a used car, which they can park on the street in front of their home. The only salient costs of owning this car will be the weekly stops at the gas station, occasional repair bills, and a yearly insurance bill. The opportunity cost of the $10,000 is likely to be neglected. In other words, once they purchase the car, they tend to forget about the $10,000 and stop treating it as money that could have been spent on something else. In contrast, every time the family uses a taxi, the cost will be in their face, with the meter clicking every few blocks. So a behavioral analysis of the incentives of car ownership will predict that people will underweigh the opportunity costs of car ownership and possibly other less salient aspects, such as depreciation, and may overweigh the very salient costs of using a taxi. An analysis of choice architecture systems must make similar adjustments. Of course, salience can be manipulated, and good choice architects can take steps to direct people's attention to incentives. The telephones at the INSEAD School of Business in France are programmed to display the running costs of long-distance phone calls. If we want to protect the environment and to increase energy independence, similar strategies could be used to make costs more salient. Suppose the thermostat in your home was programmed to tell you the cost per hour of lowering the temperature a few degrees during the heat wave. This would probably have more effect on your behavior than quietly raising the price of electricity, a change that will be experienced only at the end of the month when the bill comes. Suppose in this light that government wants to increase energy conservation. Increases in the price of electricity will surely have an effect, making the increases salient will have a greater effect. Cost disclosing thermostats might have a greater impact than, modest, price increases designed to decrease use of electricity. In some domains, people may want the salience of gains and losses treated asymmetrically. For example, no one would want to go to a health club that charged its users on a per-step basis on the Stairmaster. However, many Stairmaster users enjoy watching the calories burned meter while they work out, especially since those meters seem to give generous estimates of calories actually burned. Even better for some might be a pictorial display that indicated the calories one had burned in terms of food. After 10 minutes, one had earned only a bag of carrots, but after 40 minutes, a large cookie. We have sketched 6 examples of good choice architecture. As a concession to the bounded memory of our readers, We thought it might be useful to offer a mnemonic device to help recall the six examples. By rearranging their order and using one small fudge, the following emerges. Incentives. Understand mappings. Defaults. Give feedback. Expect error. Structure complex choices. Voila! Nudges. With an eye on these nudges, choice architects can improve the outcomes for their human users. Part 2. Money. Not surprisingly, humans differ dramatically from econs in how they deal with money. Econs are sensible spenders and savers. They put money away for a rainy day and for retirement, and they invest that money as if they had MBAs. When they borrow, econs have no trouble choosing between fixed and variable rate mortgages, and they pay their credit card bills on time every month. If you are an econ, you can skip this section of the book, unless you want to understand the behavior of your spouse, kids, and other humans. A major goal of the next four chapters is to explore how people can do a better job at the difficult tasks of saving, investing, and borrowing. We also offer some suggestions about how private and public institutions might nudge people in directions that will make them a bit wealthier and more secure. Chapter 6. Save More Tomorrow. In 2005, the personal savings rate for Americans was negative for the first time since 1932 and 1933, the Great Depression years. On average, American households spent more than they earned and borrowed more than they saved. Increased borrowing rates were fueled by substantial growth in home equity loans and in credit card debt. For many Americans, savings rates, especially retirement savings, are woefully low, if not zero. Consider, for example, the case of Tony Snow, the former White House press secretary, who resigned at age 52 in 2007 to return to the private sector. He said his motivation for leaving was financial. "I ran out of money," he told reporters. "We took out a loan when I came to the White House, and that loan is now gone, so I'm going to have to pay the bills." Before serving as press secretary, Snow worked a much more lucrative gig as a Fox News Channel anchor. But he arrived at the White House not having learned retirement 101 lessons. Snow conceded, "As a matter of fact, I was even too dopey to get into a 401k. The fact that many people are not saving for retirement exacerbates the looming problems facing the Social Security system. As all politicians know, but few are willing to say, we will eventually have to bite the bullet in order to make Social Security solvent through some combination of tax increases or benefit cuts. Americans would be better able to deal with this problem if they were saving more on their own." And indeed, the government has often passed laws designed to encourage personal savings, typically by creating tax-favored savings accounts such as IRAs and 401ks. Such programs are well-intended, but many Americans who are eligible for such plans do not take full advantage of them. What can be done to help? We will be offering two central suggestions. The first is automatic enrollment in savings plans. The second is the Save More Tomorrow program. To understand why these nudges would work and why they are not part of the usual economics repertoire, we need to step back a bit. The standard economic theory of saving for retirement is both elegant and simple. People are assumed to calculate how much they are going to earn over the rest of their lifetime, figure out how much they will need when they retire, and then save up just enough to enjoy a comfortable retirement without sacrificing too much while they are still working. As a guideline for how to think sensibly about saving, this theory is excellent, but as an approach to how people actually behave, the theory runs into two serious problems. First, it assumes that people are capable of solving a complicated mathematical problem in order to figure out how much to save. Without good computer software, even a trained economist would find this problem daunting. The truth is that we know few economists, and no lawyers, who have made a serious attempt at doing it, even with software. The second problem with the theory is that it assumes that people have enough willpower to implement the relevant plan. Under the standard theory, flashy sports cars or nice vacations never distract people from their project of saving up for a condo in Florida. In short, the standard theory is about econs, not humans. For most of their time on Earth, humans did not have to worry much about saving for retirement because most people did not live long enough to have much of a retirement period. In most societies, those who did make it to old age were cared for by their children. In the 20th century, the combination of rising life expectancies and geographical dispersion of families made it necessary for people to think about providing for their own retirement income rather than depending on their children to do it. Both employers and governments began to take steps to help with this problem, with Bismarck's early Social Security program in Germany leading the way in 1889. Early pension plans tended to be defined benefit plans. In such plans, participants are entitled to a benefit that depends on a specific formula, typically based on the participant's salary and the number of years the participant was a member of the plan. In a typical private plan, a worker is entitled to receive a benefit that is a proportion of the salary paid over the last few years of work, the proportion depending on years of service. Most public Social Security systems, including that of the United States, are also defined benefit plans. Your Social Security check depends on the amount you have paid in taxes and the number of years you have worked. The payouts are even adjusted for inflation, so you know exactly what you will be paid, unless Congress changes its mind, as it is entitled to do. The Constitution does not protect your right to Social Security benefits. From the perspective of choice architecture, defined benefit plans have one large virtue. They are forgiving to even the most mindless of humans. With Social Security, the only decision a worker has to make is when to start receiving benefits. The only form to fill out is the one where you write down your Social Security number, and you have to fill it out if you want to get paid. In the private sector, defined benefit plans are also easy and forgiving, as long as the worker keeps working for the same employer and the employer stays in business. The decision about when to retire is not so easy. But it is only one decision. The same is true for the decision about when to start claiming Social Security benefits. We discuss that decision and how the government might offer some useful nudges at the end of this chapter. While a defined benefit world can be an easy one for someone who stays in one job her entire life, employees who change jobs frequently can end up with virtually no retirement benefits because there is often a minimum employment period, such as 5 years, before any benefits are vested. That is, owned by the employee. Defined benefit plans are also expensive for employers to administer. Many old firms are switching over to defined contribution plans, and nearly all new firms offer only defined contribution plans. Under a defined contribution plan, employees, and sometimes employers, make specific contributions to a tax-sheltered account in the employee's name. The benefits received by employees in retirement depend on the decisions they make about how much to save and how to invest. Defined contribution plans, such as 401k plans in the United States, have many desirable features for modern workers. The plans are completely portable, so a worker is free to move from one job to another. The plans are also flexible, giving employees the opportunity to adjust their savings and investment decisions to reflect their own financial situation and tastes. However, defined contribution plans are not very forgiving. Employees have to get around to joining, to figuring out how much to save, to managing their portfolio over a period of years, and then to deciding what to do with the proceeds when they finally retire. People can find the whole process frightening, and many seem to be making a mess of the task. Are people saving enough? Of course, a key question is whether people are saving enough. Are they? This turns out to be a complex and controversial question. For one thing, economists do not agree about how much saving is appropriate because they do not agree on the right level of post-retirement income. Some economists argue that people should aim to have retirement income that is at least as high as the income enjoyed when working, because retirement years offer the opportunity for such time-intensive, expensive activities as travel. Retired people also have to worry about growing health care costs. Others claim that retirees can use their greater time to live a more economical lifestyle, saving the money once spent on business clothes, taking the time to shop carefully and prepare meals at home, and taking advantage of senior discounts. We do not take a strong position on this debate, but consider a few points. It seems clear that the costs of saving too little are greater than the costs of saving too much. There are many ways to cope with having saved too much, from retiring earlier than expected, to taking up golf, to traveling to Europe, to spoiling the grandchildren. Coping in the opposite direction is less pleasant. Second, we can say for sure that some people in our society are definitely saving too little, namely, those employees who are not participating at all in their retirement plan or who are saving a low percentage of their income after having reached their 40s or older. These folks could clearly use a nudge. For what it is worth, many employees say that they should be saving more. In one study, 68% of 401k participants said that their savings rate is too low, 31% said that their savings rate is about right, and only 1% said their savings rate is too high. Economists tend to belittle such statements, and partly for good reason. It is easy to say that you should be doing many good things, dieting, exercising, spending more time with your children, and people's actions may tell us more than their words. After all, few of the participants who say they should be saving more make any changes in their behavior, but such statements are not meaningless or random. Many people announce an intention to eat less and exercise more next year, but few say they hope to smoke more next year or watch more sitcom reruns. We interpret the statement, "I should be saving," or "dieting," or "exercising more," to imply that people would be open to strategies that would help them achieve these goals. In other words, they are open to a nudge. They might even be grateful for one. Enrollment decisions, nudging people to join. The first step in participating in a defined contribution plan, such as a 401k, is to enroll. Most workers should find joining the plan very attractive. Contributions are tax deductible, accumulations are tax deferred, and in many plans the employer matches at least part of the contributions of the employee. For example, a common plan feature is that the employer will match 50% of the employee's contributions up to some threshold, such as 6% of salary. This match is virtually free money. Taking full advantage of the match should be a no-brainer for all but the most impatient or cash-strapped households. Nevertheless, enrollment rates in such plans are far from 100%. Roughly 30% of the employees eligible to join a 401k plan fail to enroll. Typically, younger, less educated, and lower-income employees are less likely to join, but even high-paid workers sometimes fail to sign up, as the Tony Snow example illustrates. To be sure, there are situations, say for young workers with other pressing financial needs, in which it would be sensible not to join even with an employer match. But in many cases, a failure to join is simply a blunder. One extreme example comes from the United Kingdom, where some defined benefit plans do not require any employee contributions and are fully paid by the employer. They do require employees to take action to join the plan. Data on 25 such plans reveal that scarcely half of the eligible employees, 51%, signed up. This is equivalent to not bothering to cash your paycheck. Some older American workers are also turning down free money. To have this free money option, a worker must meet three qualifications. He needs to be more than 59.5 years old, so that he faces no tax penalty when he withdraws funds from his retirement account. His firm has to offer a matching contribution, meaning that the firm contributes something if the employee does, and his employer has to allow employees to withdraw funds from their retirement accounts while still working. For such employees, joining the plan is a sure profit opportunity because they can join, then immediately withdraw their contributions without any penalty, yet keep the employer match. Nonetheless, a study finds that up to 40% of eligible workers either do not join the plan at all or do not save enough to get the full match. These extreme examples are just the clearest cases in which people's failure to join a plan is foolish beyond a doubt. In many other cases, workers take months or years to join the plan, and it is a reasonable assumption that most of these workers are just spacing out or procrastinating rather than making a reasoned decision that they have a better use for their money. How can we nudge these people to join more quickly? Making savings automatic. An obvious answer is to change the default rule. As things now stand, The default is non-enrollment. You have to do a little work to get into a retirement plan. When workers are first eligible to join, sometimes immediately upon employment, they usually receive a form to fill out. Employees who want to join must decide how much to put aside and how to allocate their investments among the funds offered in the plan. Forms can be a headache, and many employees just put them aside. An alternative is to adopt automatic enrollment. Here's how it works. When an employee first becomes eligible, she receives a form indicating that she will be enrolled in the plan at a specified savings rate and asset allocation, unless she actively fills out a form asking to opt out. Automatic enrollment has proven to be an extremely effective way to increase enrollment in U.S. defined contribution plans. In one plan studied in an early paper by Bridget Madrian and Dennis Shea, 2001, participation rates under the opt-in approach were barely 20% after 3 months of employment, gradually increasing to 65% after 36 months. But when automatic enrollment was adopted, enrollment of new employees jumped to 90% immediately and increased to more than 98% within 36 months. Automatic enrollment thus has two effects. Participants join sooner, and more participants join eventually. Does automatic enrollment merely overcome workers' inertia, helping them make the choice they would actually prefer? Or does automatic enrollment somehow seduce workers into saving when they would prefer to be spending? One telling bit of evidence is that under automatic enrollment, very few employees drop out of the plan once enrolled. In a study of four companies that adopted automatic enrollment, the fraction of 401k participants who dropped out of the plan in the first year was only 0.3 to 0.6 percentage points higher than it had been before automatic enrollment was introduced. Although the low dropout rate is, of course, partly due to inertia, the fact that so few people drop out does suggest that workers are not suddenly discovering, to their dismay, that they are saving more than they had wanted. Forced choosing and more simplicity. An alternative to automatic enrollment is simply to require every employee to make an active decision about whether to join the plan. If a worker is eligible when he is first hired, he might be required to check a yes or a no box for participation in order to get paid. With required choosing in place, employees have to state their preferences and there is no default option. As compared with the usual opt-in approach, you are not enrolled unless you decide to fill out the forms, required choosing should increase participation rates. One company switched from an opt-in regime to active decisions and found that participation rates increased by about 25 percentage points. A related strategy is to simplify the enrollment process. One study tested this idea by analyzing a simplified enrollment form. New employees were handed enrollment cards during orientation, with a yes box for joining the plan at a 2% savings rate and a pre-selected asset allocation. Employees did not have to spend time choosing a savings rate and asset allocation. They could just check the yes box for participation. As a result, participation rates during the first 4 months of employment jumped from 9% to 34%. These simplified enrollment procedures are very much in the spirit of the channel factors we mentioned in Chapter 3. People really do want to join the plan, and if you dig a channel for them to slide down that removes the seemingly tiny barriers that are getting in their way, the results can be quite dramatic. While automatic enrollment or quick enrollment makes the process of joining a retirement plan less daunting, expanding the number of funds available to participants can have the opposite effect. One study finds that the more options in the plan, the lower the participation rates. This finding should not be surprising. With more options, the process becomes more confusing and difficult, and some people will refuse to choose at all. Choosing contribution rates. Both automatic enrollment programs and forced choosing plans typically adopt a relatively low default savings rate of 2 or 3% and a very conservative investment choice, such as a money market account. It turns out that many employees continue saving at the default rate of 2%. This rate is usually far too low to provide enough money for retirement. Many employees also remain in a default investment fund, and they lose a lot of money as a result. We will turn to investment strategies in the next chapter. Here, let's see how we can help nudge the people who are saving too little. One indication that people need help in picking a savings rate and don't realize that they need the help is that most people spend very little time on this important financial decision. One survey found that 58% spent less than 1 hour determining both their contribution rate and investment decisions. Most people spend more time than that picking a new tennis racket or television set. Apparently, many people are using some simple shortcuts. In many plans, participants are asked to state a desired savings rate as a percentage of pay. Many people simply pick a round number, typically 5, 10, or 15% of income. Of course, there is no sensible reason why the correct percentage of your income to save would be an exact multiple of 5. Another common rule of thumb is to contribute to a retirement account the minimum amount necessary to get the full employer match. If the employer matches employees' contributions up to 6% of pay, then many employees contribute 6%. If participants are behaving this way, then firms wanting to encourage employee savings might alter their matching formula to help workers. Changing the match formula from 50% of the first 6% of pay to 30% of the first 10% of pay would probably increase contribution rates. Those who use the match threshold as a rule of thumb would save more with a higher matching threshold. And by picking a round number as the threshold, the company would nudge those who use the multiple of 5 heuristic. Education. What else can employers do if they want more employees to enroll in retirement plans, contribute an amount that will build a reasonable retirement nest egg, and allocate the funds among assets in an appropriate, diversified way? Education is the obvious answer, and many employers have tried to educate their employees to make better decisions. Unfortunately, the evidence does not suggest that education is, in and of itself, an adequate solution. One large employer, having offered its employees the chance to switch from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan, provided a free financial education program. The employer measured the effectiveness of this education by administering a before and after test of financial literacy. The quiz used a true-false format, so random answers would receive, on average, a score of 50%. Before the education, the average score of the employees was 54. After the education, the average score crept up to 55. Teaching is hard. Employees often leave educational seminars excited about saving more, but then fail to follow through on their plans. One study found that at the seminar, everyone expressed an interest in saving more, but only 14% actually joined the savings plan. This was an improvement, but not a large one, over the 7% of comparable employees who did not attend a seminar and joined the savings plan. Studies of the effects of attendance at a benefits fair also find only a small effect on participation in a tax-deferred savings account. Save more tomorrow. Although automatic enrollment is effective at getting new and young workers to enroll sooner than they would have otherwise, participants tend to stick with the default contribution rate, which is typically quite low. To mitigate this problem, consider a program of automatic escalation of contributions developed by Thaler and his frequent collaborator, Shlomo Benarzi, called Save More Tomorrow. Save More Tomorrow is a choice architecture system that was constructed with close reference to 5 psychological principles that underlie human behavior. Many participants say that they think they should be saving more and plan to save more, but never follow through. Self-controlled restrictions are easier to adopt if they take place sometime in the future. Many of us are planning to start diet soon, but not today. Loss aversion. People hate to see their paychecks go down. Money illusion. Losses are felt in nominal dollars, that is, not adjusted for inflation, so a dollar in 1995 is seen as worth the same as a dollar in 2005. Inertia plays a powerful role. Save More Tomorrow invites participants to commit themselves, in advance, to a series of contribution increases timed to coincide with pay raises. By synchronizing pay raises and savings increases, participants never see their take-home amounts go down, and they don't view their increased retirement contributions as losses. Once someone joins the program, The saving increases are automatic, using inertia to increase savings rather than prevent savings. When combined with automatic enrollment, this design can achieve both high participation rates and increased savings rates. The first implementation of Save More Tomorrow occurred in 1998 at a mid-sized manufacturing firm. Employees were given the opportunity to meet one-on-one with a financial consultant. The consultant had a laptop with software designed to compute suggested savings rates based on relevant information provided by each employee, such as past savings and the retirement plan of a spouse. About 90% of the employees accepted the offer to meet with a financial consultant. Many were a bit surprised by what they heard. Because most employees were saving at very low rates, the advisor told almost every employee that he needed to save a lot more. Often, the software suggested a savings rate equal to the maximum allowed in the plan, 15% of pay. But the consultant quickly realized that such suggestions were immediately rejected as infeasible, so he generally suggested increasing the savings rate by 5 percentage points of pay. About 25% of the participants accepted this advice and immediately increased their savings rates by the recommended 5 percentage points. The rest said they could not afford the cut in pay. These reluctant savers were offered the Save More Tomorrow program. Specifically, they were offered a plan in which their savings rates would go up by 3 percentage points every time they got a pay raise. A typical pay raise was about 3.25 to 3.5%. Of this group of employees who were unwilling to increase their savings rate immediately, 78% joined the program to increase their contribution with every pay raise. The results provide a dramatic illustration of the potential power of choice architecture. Compare the behavior of three groups of employees. The first group consists of those who chose not to meet with the consultant. This group was saving about 6% of their income when the program started, and that percentage did not budge over the next 3 years. The second group contains the employees who accepted the advice to increase their savings rates by 5 percentage points. Their average savings rate jumped by just over 4% to just over 9% after the first raise occurred. This rate was then essentially consistent over the next few years. The third group includes those who joined the Save More Tomorrow plan. That group started with the lowest savings rate of the three groups, about 3.5% of income. Under the program, however, their savings rate steadily rose, and 3.5 years and 4 pay raises later, their savings rate had almost quadrupled to 13.6%, considerably higher than the 9% savings rate for those who accepted the consultant's initial recommendation to raise savings by 5 percentage points. Most of the people who enrolled in the Save More Tomorrow program stuck with it for the full 4 raises, whereupon the increases were halted because the employees had reached the maximum they were allowed to contribute to the plan. The few employees who did leave the program did not ask that their savings rate be dropped back to their earlier low levels. Instead, they just stopped increasing their contribution rates. In the years since this pilot program, many retirement plan administrators have adopted the Save More Tomorrow idea, including Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, TIAA Cref, Fidelity, and Hewitt Associates. Save More Tomorrow is now available in thousands of employer plans. The Profit Sharing Council of America reports that as of 2007, 39% of large employers in the United States have adopted some type of automatic escalation plan. As the plan is implemented in various ways, we have been able to learn more about what makes the program work. In the first implementation, as we have seen, participation was more than 80%, but this was an environment in which each employee was approached individually by the financial consultant, and the consultant was able to fill out the relevant form on the spot. In contrast, participation rates have been small in some cases in which employees have had to hunt for an obscure location on a financial services webpage in order to sign up. Our main conclusion should not be surprising to anyone who has read this far into the book. Participation rates jump when enrollment is easy. Holding a seminar to explain the plan helps. Having the forms there to fill out helps even more. Have we mentioned that channel factors matter? The most effective way to increase enrollment in a Save More Tomorrow plan is to combine it with automatic enrollment. The SafeLight Group was the first to implement automatic enrollment in a Save More Tomorrow plan. The program was introduced to employees in June 2003. 93% of participants took no action and thus were automatically enrolled in the program. In the year following the implementation of the program, only 6% actively opted out. Those who stayed in the program will have significantly more money available for retirement. More recently, Vanguard has introduced 13 automatic Save More Tomorrow enrollment plans. These programs cover new hires only, and they are typically set with an initial deferral rate of about 3% of pay and an annual increment of 1% of pay. In the 12 months before the implementation of automatic enrollment, only 23% of employees opted into Save More Tomorrow. In the 12 months following automatic enrollment, 78% of the savers were participating in the program. The dramatic change in participation illustrates the power of inertia, and with respect to savings, the crucial role of choice architecture. The role of government. The initiatives discussed thus far have been entirely a private sector phenomenon. Firms have tried automatic enrollment without any nudging from the government. The primary role government needed to play was getting out of the way by reducing the barriers to adoption of these programs. To an increasing extent, the federal government has done exactly that. Beginning in June 1998, Mark Every, then a Treasury Department official in charge of national pension policy, directed the Internal Revenue Service to issue a series of rulings and official pronouncements that defined, approved, and promoted the use of automatic enrollment in 401k and other retirement savings plans. In the summer of 2006, Congress passed the Pension Protection Act with enthusiastic backing of both sides of the aisle. The details are complex and boring, so we will put those in an endnote and simply point out that the law offers employers an incentive to match employee contributions, automatically enroll them in the plan, and automatically increase their contribution rates over time. The incentive is that the employer is given a waiver from an annoying regulation. Although reasonable people can quibble with the specific provisions of the bill, which represent the usual sort of political compromises, we think that it is an excellent example of nudging. Employers are not required to change their plans, but if they do, they get a reward that actually saves the taxpayers money, because no one has to read or check the form that no longer has to be completed. That is not to deny that government can badly blunder. Consider as a case in point the Social Security Administration. As we mentioned earlier, being a Social Security participant is a job even the most clueless of humans can handle because there is one and only one decision to make: when to start claiming benefits. The decision about when to start receiving benefits is independent of when to quit working. One can start collecting while still working, and one can stop working and delay collecting. Generally, a worker is eligible to start claiming benefits when she reaches age 62. However, she can delay the start until age 70, and the longer you wait to start receiving checks, the larger the checks get. Deciding when to start collecting the money is a tricky problem, even for an economist. Some of the factors that should go into your calculation include how long you expect to live, the age, health, working history, and retirement expectations of your spouse, how much money you plan to make in the near future. If you make money, then Social Security benefits are heavily taxed. Impatience. The more eager you are to get the money, the higher your discount rate in economics parlance, the sooner you should start. The Social Security Administration helpfully sends every American worker an annual statement that estimates how much she will collect if she retires at various ages. But for assistance in deciding when to start receiving benefits, participants are referred to the SSA webpage for help. We decided to have a look. We discovered that the only tool available to help you is something called the Break-Even Age Calculator. This is the tool that is meant to help you decide whether to start collecting at age 62 or wait until, say, age 66. One might think that this calculator would allow you to enter some information about the four factors mentioned above that should influence this choice. Instead, all the calculator does is tell you, given two possible start dates for receiving payments, how many years you have to live to break even. The calculator does not take interest, taxes, spouses, or anything else into account. The SSA might as well give every senior an abacus. If the SSA had a designated choice architect, she could surely do better. It would be possible to ask a series of questions to get at the important four factors. Examples: Are you in good